The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and in your life. Yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting Yes And is Emma Seppala. Emma is Science Director of Stanford University's Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education. She is also co-director of the Yale College Emotional Intelligence Project and a lecturer at Yale College, where she teaches the psychology of happiness. She is the author of The Happiness Track and has consulted with Fortune 500 leaders and employees on building a positive organization. She is also the founder and editor-in-chief of Fulfillment Daily, a popular news site dedicated to the science of happiness. Emma, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And you have a cold, so I'm thankful, but I think we should own up to the fact that you're doing this under duress.
No, I'm happy to be here. I just apologize if I'm a little nasal.
Oh, no, you sound great. So I want to start with this. You wrote a piece a few months back for the Stanford Medicine blog Scope about embracing hardship. And that might seem counterintuitive to a lot of people, but one of my favorite improv tenets comes from the actor and teacher Rick Thomas. He talks about, quote, diving into the crack in the game. And the idea there is that you make mistakes work for you. That's the thing you do in improvisation. But you actually have some data behind this. You were talking about, quote, embracing difficult situations. It actually increases well-being.
That's right. So whenever we resist a certain experience or emotions, we actually make them probably last longer than they need to. And research on acceptance and mindfulness types of practices show that when we actually accept the emotions as they come, we actually allow them to pass more quickly as well. And that's just one example.
It also brings to mind,
you know, the Rumi's poem or Rumi's quote, that the crack is the place where the light comes through. Mm-hmm. And especially in the United States, we really value positive emotions, positive experiences. We don't want to feel bad. We love pain meds. We love numbing ourselves through any difficult situation. And yet, if you look back on your life, it's also the hardships that have made us grow, that have given us depths of compassion and understanding for others who are suffering, that have often brought meaning into our lives because they've helped us think about things in a deeper way. And so being able to also embrace those challenging, difficult, quote, negative aspects of our lives can really make our life also much richer.
Yeah, that's a very interesting thing. So I've been at Second City for 3 decades, almost 30 years. And the thing that we've seen on stage, so you have groups of people whose job is to make something out of nothing, right? They, over a 12-week period, they start with nothing. By the end, they have a show. And the way, and that seems insane, right? But the way it works is so reliant on the ability to make mistakes work for you, to see all obstacles as gifts, to not linger on those things that seem like they're wrong, instead to find a way to use them to further the narrative. To develop this ongoing story, and it becomes actually the most effective way to make this stuff together. The hard part comes when you go off stage, keeping that attitude and applying it to your life, right? Because it is just we linger in any slight. I mean, I was just having this conversation with a colleague today, where you know someone did a real shitty thing to him, and I was like, you know, you can stay in that place, or you can acknowledge that it happened and move forward. And he's like, I know. Thank you for the note. Mm-hmm. But it's not an easy thing to do, right?
Well, our brain clings to the negative. So this probably had some kind of survival benefit for our ancestors, for them to really remember very clearly what happened to Aunt Sally, who got involved with those tigers. Mm-hmm. But at this point in our evolution, focusing on the negatives that happened during the day actually clouds our perspective, because research shows 3 times more positive things happen to us every day than negative. And if you think about it, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably have earphones and you've got a device to listen to it. You probably had a meal. You probably have a roof. You're probably warm. You're probably wearing clothes. I mean, the list goes on and on and on of good things happening. And yet, you know, that person spilled coffee on us, or we received that nasty email, and all of a sudden it feels like life sucks. And really, does life suck? I don't think so. Our negativity bias really skews our perspective dramatically. And that's something we need to be aware of, because the more awareness we have, the more we can remember all the good things. We can be grateful, and that can really shift not just your perspective, it's just your life.
Yeah. And so a place you start with this in the book is where you talk about being present. So there's an improv concept, which is about playing the scene you're in, not the scene you want to be in. And you have you have research that staying present is actually a way to increase productivity even.
Absolutely. I mean, we are our mind wanders 50% of the time. So we know that 50% of the day we are not with what we are doing, which is crazy when you think about it, but we've all seen it. We've spoken to people who are not really listening to us. We've sat in front of a computer working when we're actually not doing what we're supposed to be doing. We're not even thinking about it. We struggle with being present. And then there's situations where we're in a situation we don't want to be in, and we are daydreaming about something where we'd rather be. Yet research shows again and again that we are never more happy than when we're in the present moment, even if we don't like what we're doing. That is when we're happiest, and when we are happier, we're more productive, we're more creative, we connect better with other people, and we're able to get more things done faster and more intelligently. We also make better decisions. The other thing with presence is that it's key to charisma. Hmm. We think of charisma as this je ne sais quoi, the special gift that is blessed upon someone, and yet no, if you look at the research, charisma is the ability to make someone feel like they are the only person in the room. That's what people say about, say, Bill Clinton and people and charismatic examples like that. But what is it that makes them make you feel like you're the only person in the room? They are 100% present with you. They are so present. They're more present than anyone you've ever seen, and therefore they have, quote, charisma. No, they're just there. They happen to actually be where they are, as opposed to on their phones or have their mind wandering or stressing about something that just happened.
This was a fascinating thing for me, because I never, ever considered the fact that charisma would equal being others focused. You know, I always sort of felt like, well, yeah, the people have it or they don't have it, even though our work suggests completely something different. The connect point I found there is when you start taking classes at Second City, we don't teach individuals how to be funny in the beginning improv classes. We actually teach them to focus, to listen, to stay in the moment. And we find that humor comes out just naturally out of you developing your own true voice in connection with other people simply by being present. And so this idea of charisma being learnable was really kind of a staggering concept to me, but it does feel like that's the case.
Well, it connects with what you're doing, because basically what I'm telling people is stay present. That's all you want to do. And when you're present, all that develops. Humor is such a gift. It just seems like such a gift. Again, someone has been anointed with it. It's like that special thing. And yet, like what you're saying, it comes out of people when you tell them to be present and authentic and to just move with the flow, go with the movement, go with the story, just be there. And the same thing with charisma, which is, again, being able to be there for other people, being able to listen to them, being able to fully and truly empathize with them, be enthusiastic for them, be with them.
Well, again, it's a little bit our fault, right? We've perpetuated this myth. I was talking to Angela Duckworth, and I use the term talent. She's like, stop using the word talent. That perpetuates this thing that somehow this is magic or anointed, as you say.
Right.
You also talk about that this connection is also tied to, quote unquote, knowing your audience.
Absolutely. So that charisma is you know where people are coming from. You don't just speak to them or try to connect from where you are. Who is in front of me? How are they feeling? What are they thinking? Where did they just come from? What do they need? What is it that they're wanting in their life? You know, and really being able to feel that with full sensitivity and empathy and emotion, that's the ability to connect, to really truly connect. And we know from research that after food and shelter, our number one need in life is to connect and to feel a sense of belonging. We all do, and yet research also shows that 1 in 4 Americans has no one to speak to about a personal problem. So we're seeing a crisis of disconnection, and yet all we need, the greatest thing we need after food and shelter, is connection. And for not just our happiness, but for our survival and our longevity, it has biological repercussions, how connected we feel. And if you look at the research, what is it that determines if someone is connected? It has nothing to do with how many friends they have on Facebook or otherwise. Mm-hmm. It has everything to do with their subjective, internal feeling of connection. You could walk out into the streets of New York, know nobody there, and yet feel completely connected to everyone. Then you are connected. Or you could walk into a cocktail where everyone knows you and you know everybody, but you feel alone in the crowd. So, again, that sense of connection, internal, it's all internal. All the things we're talking about, I think both you and I, is that what is the state of your mind? What is the state of your heart? What is going on inside of you? Because that is determining everything that's going on outside of you.
Yeah, I mean, it's a duality, right? And mm-hmm. we know this intellectually, or let's say we get to that place where you know it intellectually, but then it's a whole other thing to then sort of externalize that or add that in. And I think you talk about this, right? That stress, we have this dysfunctional relationship with stress, and that really mm-hmm. blocks us. That gets in the way. How do we overcome that? How do we get by that stress?
Well, we've bought into the idea that we need stress. We love stress. It doesn't matter how much what we say, we love it. Look, everybody's fueling up on coffee every day like it's a normal thing. It's not a normal thing. Coffee is a drug. It's a stimulant. It leads to addiction. It also leads to withdrawal, and it leads to a crash. I mean, it's just like any other drug. And yet, it's a very normal thing that we do. And the more busy we are and the more stressed we are, the more we drink coffee, which what it does is it pumps up our adrenals to the max. It puts us into fight or flight, which is exhaust every system in our body, our immune function, our cognitive function. Everything gets taxed. And that's a sign, because the stress response is supposed to help you survive. So if you're taxing your entire body because you're fleeing from a predator, that's good, because at that moment you need all your resources. But if you're doing it day after day after day to go and sit with your butt on a chair in front of a computer in some office, you are actually then, and then you wonder, A, why you're exhausted, 2, why you're aging quickly, and 3, why you're getting all these, why your health isn't good. You got to look at how are we living our life. We're draining all of our resources. We're also draining our ability to connect, because stress focuses you on yourself. We know that from research, and it's normal, because again, if you actually were in a high stress situation where it's life or death, you need to get out of that situation. So you need to focus on yourself. But again, here we are in the situation where everybody's stressed. People aren't connecting. We're not emotionally intelligent. When you're stressed, you can't be emotionally intelligent. You can't empathize with another person because you can't really see where another person's coming from, because you haven't even noticed their facial expression, because you're so busy and wrapped up in your own nervous system and how you're feeling and how anxious things are and what's on your plate. So again, you know, it's not just coffee. It's also the way we live our lives. Like we overschedule, we overcommit, we wait until the very last minute to get things done. We rush. We have input all day long. We wake up in the morning, look at our phone, then have the news playing, have the music playing, have emails coming in, have messages coming in. We don't even know what we're dealing with right now, but in 2009, a study showed that we're taking in 30,000 gigabytes of information every day. That's equivalent to 100,000 words. It's enough to crash a laptop in about a week.
Wow.
And this is what we're doing per day. And we're wondering why we're exhausted. Mind you, 2009, the iPhone had barely just come out.
Right.
We're now in 2017. I don't want to know how many gigabytes we're taking in. But what I'm saying is, not only are we buying into the fact that we feel like we need to be stressed to be productive, and then we're wondering why we're crashing, but the way that the world is set up right now with technology is we have too much input coming in. Now, that any of our ancestors ever had even a percentage of. And so we're dealing with a whole new factors. And the question is, well, what is that doing to us? Well, we're seeing 50% burnout across industries. It doesn't matter if you're working for a nonprofit or a medical field, whatever. We're also seeing 75% of the American workforce is disengaged at work. They're at work, they're not working. They're at work, they're not focusing. They're just not there. And so what is going on? Are you more productive when you're stressed? Well, you know what? Maybe if you have a deadline coming on, looming for tomorrow, you're going to be more productive as you function towards, as you work towards it. But if you're stressed every single day, no, you won't. Your attention has declined. Your memory has declined. Your ability to connect, like I said, with others and to make decisions, all things have declined. You're not able to be creative. And creativity is the number one most useful, and it's the number one most valued trait in employees by CEOs, number one, above integrity, above everything.
Yep.
They want you to be creative because they need you to be creative. If your company doesn't innovate, forget about it. You're not going to be the leader in your field. So we can't be creative when we're stressed. That's just, if you look at the brain, it doesn't work that way. We come up with our brilliant ideas when we're in the shower, when we're taking a walk, when we're daydreaming. We don't have time for that anymore. I mean, maybe we shower, but we don't have time anymore to relax. We're not giving ourselves that time. We're stealing our own ability to be creative, to be innovative, by removing the periods of time in our life that restore us, that removing the periods of time in our life that help us rest, to help us recover, that help us play and have fun and enjoy life, enjoy nature, enjoy being outside, enjoy the little times and pockets of time that we have for ourselves.
So, I mean, yeah, it's a little bit terrifying because we're still fleeing from animals on the savannah. And then you add in this digital revolution, right? And we had Adam Alter on the podcast a few weeks ago, who talked about his research showing that even just having a phone on a table upside down impairs communication between individuals.
Yeah.
So.
Yes, exactly.
And then he did this little experiment with us, which is like, you know, put your feet on the ground. Can you reach your cell phone? And I've been doing this at conferences, and I talk to a lot of business groups, and everyone can reach their phone. It's not healthy, but it is. It's not only status quo in business, it's romanticized. Like, stress is romanticized in business.
Yep.
And
it's glorified.
Yeah. But you're exactly right. And I think, you know, honestly, the hope is, right, that the data, you know, there's such belief in big data. You know, everyone's like, well, what's the ROI on this? And if you want the ROI on creativity, put the phone down, talk to another human being, be present in the moment, and build up. And this is the biggest thing. People ask me, like, what is the one thing you want, like, when kids go through improv classes? What's the thing you want for your kid? And I'm like, I think improv teaches resilience because it's loaded with failure and they keep going at it. And, you know, you write in the book that self-control is a limited resource, which says to me, if that's true, then we need to practice. And there's not a lot of places where you can practice that.
Yeah. And the thing with self-control is that we're so used, you know, we prize it, right? Even in kids, a kid who can sit in class on his chair and not move is the best kid. A kid is meant to move. Like, it's not meant to sit with their butt on a chair. The kid is meant to run around.
Yes.
I mean, you know, there is such a thing as ADHD, but from childhood, we're training people to think a certain way and to act a certain way. And we're actually seeing huge declines, by the way, in creativity. There's a creativity crisis happening among children because of how we're training them to think. We're training them to think only logically. We don't have improv classes in schools. We hardly have art classes in schools.
Right.
In fact, they're just thinking cognitively and logically, and that is how they're being trained. And as a consequence, there has been a very rapid decline in creativity in the last 10 years, to the point where scientists are calling it a creativity crisis, despite, again, CEOs looking for creativity as the number one trait.
Yep.
And yet, I think that improv is the most important thing that they could possibly do in a school.
Yeah.
So it really is an issue. Now, in terms of self-control, we, you know, if you're an adult who has a job in the USA, you're probably really good with self-control. You controlling yourself all day long just to get through and make things happen and not say the wrong thing to your boss and get your work in on time and manage your kids and get your taxes on time. All the things we do. And yet what research has shown is that self-control is a limited resource in the sense that, you know, some studies suggest that at the end of the day, you really are more likely to reach for those donuts
than you, whatever.
But at the same time, I mean, this is one of the things I'm advocating across all the things that I'm saying, because I don't want to just present problems here because there are solutions, is that we need a different approach to building the skills that we need. We can't go live on a desert island. We need to get our work done. We may have strong ambitions that require us to work in very stressful situations and so forth and so on. And there's no reason we shouldn't follow our dreams. But there's a way to be more resilient. And there's a way to not be so taxed. And that is to actually take care of ourselves. And one of the most important ones and that research has shown in the last couple of decades is, for example, meditation, mm-hmm. which is one example. But those are kinds of exercises that can really help you calm your mind and calm your emotions, garner emotional intelligence, improve your decision making, improve your cognition, improve your memory, improve your energy levels, because what we want is more energy. We're burning through our energy. It's such a simple way, and it's such a shocking way, because we're such a mover and shaker society. To sit and do nothing it's almost repulsive to some people. I would think.
Well, it gets a bad rap. I mean, and actually, calm gets a bad rap.
I
think it's interesting because self-control is not calm. Those are two different things. And when I was reading this in your book, I was sort of like, you're right. Like, when I think about the successful situations I've had over time, it's almost always related to a storm going on and the ability to remain sort of steady and calm in that moment.
Totally. It is. When you are calm, you do not need self-control. You have it. And you do not need to exert energy upon yourself. You don't. You can make your decisions. When you're calm, you make that decision. You make that correct decision. When you're calm, you are emotionally intelligent because you have the awareness to observe the person in front of you, and you know what is going on with them, and you know how to connect with them. When you're calm and you go to the negotiation table, you are powerful. It's funny. So the research that I mentioned in one of the chapters in the happiness track is about how we define happiness. And Americans define happiness as excitement. Hmm. But if you ask East Asian individuals from Korea, China, Japan, how to define happiness, they say calm, peaceful. And there are positive emotions. It's just that they're either high intensity in the U.S. or low intensity in East Asia. And it's very interesting because we embrace high intensity for everything. We love stress. And we love excitement. Both trigger the fight or flight response in the body. So it's just real. And calmness is just, like you said, it's so unsexy. Like, like calm? You want to be calm? How bizarre. But it's so powerful because we are burning through our energy. How can we manage our energy, people are asking? To manage your energy by not spending it all in the first 5 minutes of your day or the first 5 hours of your day, because you do nurture calmness. And when you're calm, you can keep going for a long time without burning out. But if you're going like a maniac in fight or flight, you crash very quickly. And then, yeah, maybe you will go get that other coffee and maybe it'll give you a second wind. But what's happening to the adrenals inside your body? Your body is slowly breaking down on the inside. And I'm sorry to say it, but it's true, because people are in their 30s and they're having health issues and they're wondering what the heck is going on with me. And it's like, well, have you been living your life? Well, I've been living in a first world country in a city, just doing a white collar job. Like, yeah. And that you've been burning through your adrenal glands and it's impacting your entire body.
I'm guessing you were like, we get brought into tons of businesses, right? And you probably have done that sort of consulting work, right? So what I've been taken to, because our message is very similar in terms of the what we're talking about. And there's always these sort of cynical businessmen who are like, you know, and I have to appeal to their Machiavellian nature. So I would say something like, all right, you want power? If you want power, that's where calmness comes. Do you want do you want a negotiation edge? The fact that you can understand what someone else wants, that's your negotiation edge. And so it's you almost right. have to sort of like get into their dysfunctional relationship and ideas to make this stuff sort of sink in. But it is so important because, you know, while there's certainly people who are having success in the business, the vast bulk of the people I work with are burning out on a daily basis.
They absolutely are. But I think it's also as critical for their burnout is to emphasize the values, like human values, because, you know, if people are using this only as a tool to manipulate others,
yep.
It isn't really going to help them, even though they might seem like it does to them. But research again shows that, you know, when you are a more compassionately oriented leader and person in your workplace, you end up more successful, mm-hmm. and your organization does better than if it's the opposite. Because even if you are someone who you use calm to be emotionally intelligent, it's kind of a manipulative.
Yep.
It's going to actually bite you in the backside because people are going to figure out who you are.
Yeah, the idea of enduring power rather than, you know, sort of short-term manipulative power.
Yeah, enduring power. Yeah, and so that's so interesting because if you think of loyalty, right?
Yeah.
Corporations are constantly trying to buy loyalty. You buy with a bigger paycheck, better bonus, bigger perks, more this, more that. But if you ask employees what they want to be happy. They prefer to work in a place where they're happier and making less. And that's shocking, but it's not shocking if you think about it. We're human beings. As human beings, we want to feel connected. We want to feel happy with each other. When we're working, we're spending more time with the people at work than with our families. Doesn't it make sense that our human needs need to be met in terms of connection and happiness? And if you look at what is loyalty, people think that loyalty can be purchased. If it can be purchased, then it can be purchased by the next paycheck next door. Mm-hmm. Then it's not loyal. There's no loyalty in that. Loyalty is that feeling you have for that person in your life who was there for you no matter what, and they were there for you and had your best interest in mind. I hope that most people have had at least one person like that. It could have been a family member, a teacher, whatever. It could have been a first grade teacher, whoever it is. You still remember that they just loved you and wanted the best for you. And when you think about that person, and if they called today and said, hey, you know what? I need a favor. You would probably drop everything in that moment and go and do it.
Yeah.
That is loyalty. Martin Luther King and Mother Teresa, they weren't paying anybody. And yet they had so much loyalty around them. So many followers inspired by their values.
This is the thing, right? So, we'll pause on your cough.
I'm so sorry.
No. That was a perfect break because we can edit it out. You okay?
Yeah.
So this is perfect because, you know, we talk so much about on this podcast how people check their humanity at the door when they go into business, which makes no sense, right? What else do you have? And I want to – you brought up earlier this idea of how we hate doing nothing. And one of the most hilarious and disturbing stories in your book is when people were given the choice between doing nothing and getting shocked electronically.
Yes, in that study, they were told, you know, here you can sit in this room and just do nothing. And by the way, that's you can give yourself electric shocks. Remember, you rated those as pretty aversive earlier.
Mm-hmm.
People will prefer to give themselves electric shocks and sit there and do nothing, even if they rated the electric shocks as extremely aversive.
That's incredible. Why?
You wonder why people are. You wonder why people are addicted to their cell phone, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the ability to be with oneself is no longer there. And yet, if you think about it, 30 years ago, we were with ourselves. We would stand and wait for the bus, and we just stand there and wait for the bus. There was nothing else to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would stand in line at the grocery and just sort of wait. It's nowadays. You're on your phone or doing God knows what. You know, it's just the ability to do nothing. We don't have it anymore. And yet that is if you look at the brain, it's an active problem-solving mode during that time. Mm-hmm. That's when we daydream. That's when we come up with innovative ideas, solutions to our problems. If you look at kids, they're constantly in that mode. That's why they're the most creative individuals in our society. Kids are always building castles in the sky and turning. I mean, I have a two-year-old, and I'll be changing his diaper, and he's looking up at the ceiling, and there's some lamps there, and he says, "Look, Mama, train." You know, they see things because their mind is constantly in that super creative mode. It's also a very happy mode, by the way. Mm-hmm. It's an extremely happy, playful mode. And yet we are robbing ourselves of that. We are robbing our own selves of that, which is the time not only for us to generate that internal happiness that's there, that internal playfulness, but it also gives us deep rest, which, again, we really desperately need in our busy times, but also it gives us the ability to come up with solutions we may be working on, either at work or in personal life. Maybe you're struggling with something, trying to figure out the answer. Most of us are doing that at one point or another about something. And those are the times when your brain could offer you the solution on a gold platter, and yet maybe you've robbed yourself of that time.
And I thought this was, and I've actually used this. You talked about this in the book, and I applied it to some work that I was doing. But this idea of diversifying rote work from creative work, and I thought this was really interesting because for many of us, right, if we have to work on, we're writing a paper or a presentation or whatever, and we're just going to slog it out and do it, and then at the end of it, you're like, this is not what I wanted it to be. What I took from your book is like, take a moment and walk away, you know, for 10 minutes mm-hmm. and do something silly, you know, or whatever. Go have a conversation with someone and then go back. And the minute I went back, I found myself, I could sort of start and stop flow. That was an okay thing to do, which previously I don't think I really realized that might work.
Absolutely, because when you go off, especially if you do something in between that's not cognitively taxing, that's not demanding a lot of focus, like I wouldn't go on, you know, Facebook or on some news site where you're focusing on articles. That's not going to help you. But if you go and do something like you sort the mail or you go grocery shopping or whatever, something where your brain can access, whereas it's not completely focused, so it's actually going into that problem-solving mode, then you'll come back with greater creativity, fresher eyes, new ideas. Yeah.
Yeah, it really works.
It really does.
So we're coming to the end of our conversation, and the way that we end the podcast is we always ask our guest for a yes and story. So the idea in improvisation is that you can't start with no. You can't even just say yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I wonder for you, was there a moment in your life or your career, a time where absolutely that thing was going to be a no, and maybe even it started as a no, but it turned into a yes and. Do you have one of those moments for us?
Yes, and it has to do with my husband.
Okay, let's hear it.
I was going through a divorce and from someone who had been quite physically aggressive, let's put it that way, mm-hmm. and I was I went on a date with someone who was in the military, and I thought there's no way that I'm going to continue this because he's in the military, which means he's probably aggressive, which is my bias, by the way, which I realized completely false. But so I kept being like, no, and I literally. But then in my heart, I literally woke up 3 days after our first date, and my heart was kind of hurting. And I realized that I missed him, but it was like a physical sense. It had to be my body giving me a physical sensation in my heart in order for me to proceed. And I kept proceeding on my heels. It was like I was walking toward him, digging my heels in the whole time. Like, this cannot be. We don't have enough in common. He's younger. I'm from Europe. He's from Wisconsin. Doesn't make sense. You know, it didn't make logical sense, and yet I realized that's all. It doesn't have to make logical sense. Mm-hmm. It turned out we share the exact same values, and he's the most nonviolent person I've ever met in my life. And it actually made me realize that's the kind of person I do want to have. That's the kind of person I want to know is handling a gun, not the other way around, if that makes sense.
Totally.
Yeah, and so that's my story. And he's just wonderful.
That's the best yes and story we've had. Emma Seppala, thank you for coming on the show.
It's been my great pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.